Welcome to Managing Safety, brought to you by the FAA Production Studios, a joint effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and the FAA Safety Team, the FAST Team. This talk show addresses strategies for thinking in today's complex aviation world. Now, here's Kathleen O'Brien, FAST Team Program Manager from Long Beach, California, who is today's host.
My name is Kathleen O'Brien, and my guest today is Jeff McCord. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Kathleen.
Jeff, tell me a little bit about your background before we get started.
One part of my background is I was an air traffic controller for 24 years, retired 2.5 years ago, and worked at several different towers and radar facilities. I am also an active pilot of a multi-engine ATP and type rated in the L-39, Lear 30 series, and Lear 55 series aircraft. And I do flying right now for hire. I tow banners, I fly traffic watch, I fly the L-39. I have a lot of fun.
I was just going to say, it's no fair. Too much fun. We have a very serious subject today that I'm really interested in, and something that I think our listeners would find intriguing, and that is the training of air traffic controllers. Tell us, you were an active air traffic controller. What kind of facilities did you work in?
I worked at level 2 towers, which would be, I can name those. It was Brackett Tower, Fullerton Tower.
So those are small, busy, local airfields in busy airspace.
That's correct. Mostly general aviation.
Okay.
Went to John Wayne Airport, which was very busy at the time, handled scheduled air carriers along with general aviation. I also worked at San Francisco Tower, which was all primarily air carrier aviation. Also worked at Coast Approach in SoCal TRACON, which is the radar facility in Southern California.
And that is a very busy and complicated facility.
It's actually the world's busiest facility of its kind, and it has been since it opened in 1994.
It's unbelievable.
There's a lot of airplanes out there.
Well, when you learned to be a controller, what was the process like?
The process was going to the FAA Academy in Oklahoma City.
Well, that's a hard thing to do. You start off with...
Yes, it was. It was a bit of a culture shock, for one, and the way the training was set up, it really didn't have that much to do with what was going on in the field. It was more of a screening process. So when I went to the academy in 1982, right after the strike in 81, I was taught non-radar approach control, and that was the way that they could screen people to see if they had the aptitude to continue to learn the job in the field.
What kind of aptitude are they looking for? Where are they looking for?
They're looking for people who can handle stress, people who can make decisions on a constantly evolving puzzle, and short-term memory things. There's a whole list of things that it was a whole other subject we could talk about if you want to, but that's basically what they're looking for.
It sounded a little bit like a trial by fire.
It is. It really was. And out of the 480 people that signed up on the first day, 180 of us graduated.
Wow.
So there was quite a bit of washout rate, but they needed to do that to fill the ranks as fast as they could with people that they knew could make the program.
So you've been doing this, and then you've had a full career, 25 years of controlling, and now I find that you're actually training controllers, and you're excited about it.
I did a lot of corporate flying after I retired and got tired of the traveling and got back to SoCal TRACON as a contractor. So I worked for Raytheon Corporation, and we provide all of the training now for all controllers from the academy through every facility. So we're completely restructuring the whole entire program. It's fascinating.
Well, why would they restructure it? Why was there that even on the horizon?
They needed to restructure it because the old way wasn't filling the ranks enough. And they went to several different systems to fill in for controllers. And with the advent of the bubble of us that came in after the strike and now everybody's retiring, they needed a more efficient way to build the facilities.
So how do they get through that aptitude business? Does a controller still have to be able to handle stress, make decisions on a constantly evolving puzzle, which is, by the way, a beautiful way of putting it? How do they get through that process?
They talk about the stress, but they do it on a more educational level, and they do it on a smarter level now. And everybody that becomes a controller either goes through the military or they go through CTI, which is a college-based program. Some people actually get their degrees in air traffic control. And they go to the academy for initial training rather than screening. And then from the initial training at the academy, they'll go to the facility. And instead of going to a tower, for example, like Brackett or Fullerton, and then moving up in the ranks, we're structuring the training so someone can come through the program and go right to the SoCal TRACON level and actually start there at the top.
Why is that? Why do you think that might work better than the old way?
It's a faster way, and being more efficient with the training, they can identify the people who could do that.
Oh, it's almost like if you're a field hockey player or a football player, you're recognizing who would be a linebacker and who would be a quarterback because of their different skills and whatever they come to the plate with.
I think so. I think that's what they're playing. I don't know exactly how the program has evolved at the academy as far as screening, but based on the aptitudes displayed there and also the desire, they'll place people in the higher facilities.
Or whatever facility matches their capabilities or their aptitudes.
Their capabilities, aptitudes, and also the needs of the FAA.
Okay. Well, you mentioned something before we started. You're teaching a group of people, and you call them the millennial. Is that what they're
the millennials?
Millennials, like perennials.
It was a term that I just recently came upon with one of the other instructors, who has a background in teaching outside of the industry, and it's describing a group of people like there was the baby boomers and Generation X. Well, the millennials are people that are born after 1980. And it's a totally different way of, they have a totally different way of learning.
Well, we have the same brains that we had before 1980. In fact, we have pretty much the same brains we had back when we were, you know, thousands and thousands of years ago. So why, what's different?
The environment that they grew up in is totally different. For example, I had a conversation with my son. We were discussing old technology and new technology. He always grew up having a microwave, grew up having a remote on the TV. Then we got into cell phones and pagers and things like that. And calculators were a thing you just go to Target and pick up for $20. When I was growing up, and I'm sorry for sounding like a cliche, I actually did use a slide rule. I actually did get up off the couch, go over and turn to one of the four channels on the TV set that was in black and white. So there's a different way of learning things, and they also are very used to multitasking in their learning. For example, learning on the computer, they can listen to music and they can text and they can do something or task on the computer and they can watch TV at the same time. We didn't have that technology growing up. They have it and they're used to it.
So they're able, I was reading recently in the Scientific American Quarterly on the brain, that we really don't multitask on our short-term memory. It's almost like putting marbles in a tube. As you add a marble, something falls out the tube. If that's indeed the case, what we do have that attention capability of 7 to 9 things. The hunter, I was talking to a flight instructor today who taught a fellow from Africa who used to hunt with his bare hands. So he had an awareness of his environment that's beyond me. It sounds like the millennials have a capacity to take in, use their brains to take in their environment in a way that those of us who are pre-1980 somewhat don't have that skill. Our skill's somewhere else.
That makes a lot of sense. That's true. It's more of, because there's so much information coming at a person now from so many different directions, having been born into that and being raised into that, they're very accepting of that.
So it's almost like a young child isn't afraid of a computer the way I was when I first encountered one.
Right.
Something goes wrong and they just keep playing until they make it right. I took it personally when the computer would crash on me. But these are different people. So the millennials are people that handle information differently, And we're now in the FAA teaching them differently.
Yes.
And our system is different, isn't it?
It is. Vastly different.
So we're going to take a little bit of a break and come back and maybe describe what makes our system different, where we're going with that, and then how the new training for the people that learn differently, how that's matching the needs of our system.
Okay.
Thank you, Jeff. This is Kathleen O'Brien. This will be back in a couple of minutes.
Now, let's rejoin Kathleen O'Brien and Managing Safety, brought to you by the FAA Production Studios.
Welcome back. This is Kathleen O'Brien with Jeff Accord, and today we're talking about the training of controllers as it's going on today. We talked a little bit about how it was in the past. It reminds me a little bit about how doctors were trained. They would have their internship and residency, and it would be a trial by fire. And now we have to be a little more effective and efficient. And you're saying that the people that you're training, really, especially people born after 1980, have a different set of techniques and different ways they learn. So the millennials, tell us what our air system is like. Has it changed in the past, like, 10 years?
It's changed dramatically. The biggest change would be the advent of GPS. And then the navigation system for
Well,
that.
What does that have to do with air traffic? I mean, I thought that was just those of us flying around saying, I want to go direct.
Actually, almost everybody now wants to go direct, and actual routes have been set up for GPS use. If you look at specifically the navigation routes through the Southern California area, we have what's called T routes, and those are set up for IFR and VFR for GPS usage. The visual reporting points are not. A lot of them are GPS points. A lot of the terminal and route control routes, the tech routes, for example, in Southern California, they've removed the parts where it's crossing radials or an intersection, and they put a specific point and named it so that it could be put in the GPS database. So the whole way of navigating, even down to approaches, is evolving into all GPS.
So it gives many more possibilities.
Absolutely.
But doesn't that also increase complexity?
Yes and no. They're going at it very precisely, and they're doing it with a lot of common sense. They're overlaying. It started with overlying existing approaches, and they're slowly evolving into the system using GPS. So it matches up still. There's no free fight yet, of course. And my personal opinion, I don't think there will be in the lower levels of altitudes just because of the complexity. But it is getting to where everything will be navigating with just GPS, and they will eventually phase out the ground-based systems.
So in the facilities that are doing air traffic control, you have GPS receivers? Is that what you... How are you using GPS, and where does radar come in?
We're using GPS for fixes that the pilots are navigating to and from. Before, on our video map in the radar room, we would have intersections and landmarks, things like that. Now in the video map, we have depicted the GPS fixes. So when we send somebody direct to a fix, and of course you can't pronounce any of them, we know exactly where it is. We actually have that on our map.
So what do you call, like, USIP is the fix outside of Long Beach for a GPS approach?
I give it the best shot I can so it sounds at least similar to it.
Okay.
That's all
I wonder if that's a safety issue.
I think eventually it will be, and I think hopefully they will get to a point where they will be pronounceable. From what I understand, it's all assigned by computer. And the only one I know of that makes sense, I don't know if it's still in effect, but there was an approach into Boston Logan that if you started at the initial approach fix, down the final to the missed approach point, in order, it would be ITOT, ITAW, APUTI, TAP.
That's the best one. And the computer there had fuzzy logic and had a sense of humor.
Actually, I think some of the procedures kind of tweaked the computer a little bit, but why not?
All right, so now we're using GPS waypoints, which means that we don't need the ground facilities, so that the money spent on those kind of infrastructures, like those lovely little VOR cones that I love to spot and see, those will eventually be going away.
Yes.
And we'll be able to put fixes where we need them, but we don't have to build physical facilities for them.
That's correct.
So now, back to the millennials that you're training. What are you doing differently in your training facility? The person who comes to you, what have they done before they got to you? They're not right off the street.
In our facility, yes. So a lot of the people are right, technically right off the street, no aviation background.
Oh, ow.
It sounds scary, but it really isn't, because we're adjusting the training just for a visual aid, and this is not an exact figure. For example, if we had somebody coming in the facility, we would give them, out of their 100% of total training from classroom to fully certified, maybe 20% was classroom and simulator, and 80% was on-the-job training. But also, they had a background when they came to the facility. They already worked at other facilities. They know what it's like to work for the government. They've even talked on a radio. They know airplane types. They're familiar with doing the job as far as timing, you know, the particular.
So they're almost like journeymen, not beginners.
Yeah, correct. That's right. And now we have people coming into the facility that have never keyed a microphone and talked on the radio.
Apprentices at the very beginning.
So now we're shifting the training, going back to black, you know, for the visual aid, it's now 80% of classroom and simulation, and then 20% on the floor. That's not exact, but I'm just trying to give a visual aid with this. So we're teaching them everything, teaching them how to talk on the radio, not just what to say, but how to say it. So everything from the beginning in our industry, we're teaching them.
Are you finding that you have a better handle on quality control when you start this way?
I think so, because we have a lot of very dedicated instructors. The majority of us are retired controllers with tremendous amount of background, and yeah, it's no joke, in my office there's over 100 years of experience, and I feel so old, but it's a good thing.
Yes.
Because we've been at various facilities, and we've been through training, we've done a lot of training over the years, and we're professionals with that, so we have a lot of control on how to do that. Yes, working for under a contract with the FAA, we have to follow their guidelines, of course, but the expertise we can bring is phenomenal.
I have a question for you that I hope isn't out of the blue. I had always thought that if you had a metronome, do you know what a metronome
is?
Yes. If you had a metronome ticking at, say, 72 beats a minute,
okay,
which is a normal pace, maybe between 60 and 72 beats, that the controllers wouldn't speed up and be so difficult to understand. Do you do anything, not just with the words, but with the way the words are said as you train a controller?
Yes, I try to teach them, or I do teach them, to be efficient on the radio. It's very easy for someone with no experience to key up the mic and think that they're talking on the telephone in a normal conversation, and it is not a normal conversation. Yes, it is a conversation, but it's a very short, concise, legal conversation with a lot of information in very few words. So I teach how to be efficient in what you say so that you can say fewer words, and exactly where to, and I believe the term is chunking, where to break up what you say so that the pilot will understand, because the general rule of thumb is if you say something to a pilot and they respond, you've done your job, they've done their job. If you say something to a pilot and they don't get it and you have to repeat yourself, you have doubled your workload. So multiply that by several thousand times a day, it adds up to a much larger workload. It's not efficient.
Is it something that comes naturally to some people, say chunking, intonation, pacing? Or is it something that you actively work on? I would understand chunking, phrasing, things like that. I've had people give me telephone numbers where they take the 7-digit telephone number and divide it not the way I want. Like they would say 439411 8. And it'll be harder for me to remember because my expectation is 3 followed by 4. How do you handle those things?
That's a really good question. What I teach is I give them examples of what the phraseology is, and I actually have them try to interpret what if they were the pilot. I put them in the pilot seat a lot.
This is music to my ears. Because that's what I was thinking as you were talking. But what about the pilots? But what about those of us who have to listen and understand?
I put it on a level of, I'm really lazy. I don't like to work really hard. The reason I don't like to work really hard at my job as a controller is so that I can give service to everybody. I'm not just giving service to one pilot. I have several pilots out there that I'm talking to all at the same time. And if I'm not efficient with one, I'm not efficient with all of them. So I put them in the pilot seat and I say, okay, write down what I'm saying. And I explain to them the difference, the background with that. I explain to them the difference of air carrier pilots versus general aviation. In air carrier, when you're talking to the pilot, you're not talking to the person that's flying. You're talking to the PNF, the pilot not flying. So they have all of their attention focused on helping the pilot and taking care of the checklist, talking to ATC, interpreting it. So the pilot's just sitting there steering the airplane.
And paying attention,
and
listening.
Paying attention, which is what they're supposed to.
Yeah.
A general aviation pilot is doing everything. They're flying, they're navigating, they're doing their charts, they're interpreting the weather, they're making their decisions.
And in many cases, they're less proficient.
They're less proficient. So they're not going to be able to absorb things at the same rate. So one of the exercises I have is, okay, I want you to pretend you're flying along. So I'll have them, like, do something physical, like tap their foot, you know, I'll make a circle.
Bounce a ball.
Some physical activity. It's okay, and write this down, and I'll spit out an instruction, just rapid fire, write it down. Okay, tell me what I said. And they're, you know, what? Okay, now don't do anything at all, just concentrate on what I'm saying. And they spit that out, and they would get that. And that's the difference. The two types of aviation. So I teach them to not just give the instructions, but give it so it fits who they're talking to. So that the pilot understands. When the pilot understands and complies, we're both connected and it's efficient and I can spend more time with everybody else.
Let me ask you, what size classes do you have? Are there 20 people in a room?
I've actually taught classes, the beginning class that we have, I had 12 people. That's the most, some of the classes where we get breaking up and get down into sectors, I'll have 2 people, maybe 3. When we get into the lab, I have a maximum of 2 people only, just because of keeping the people working on the simulator. If there's more than 2 people, then some people, you have to wait too long to get your turn. So they divide it up as no more than 2 students at that point.
If you were to say approximate percentage of the time using technology and the time one-on-one, person-to-person in this training, I mean, how much are you on Sims, for instance?
Probably about 75% of the time, the training.
Students actively engaged, almost like he's playing a computer game or she's playing.
Yes.
I mean, in the sense that they're interfacing, they're not just, it's not lecture.
No, it's not just lecture. It's very interactive classroom teaching. And then the simulator, we're teaching them as much as we possibly can in as many different types of situations or as much of a knowledge base that we can give them before they go into the room. So there's less, a better way to say it is when they get into the control room and actually on the job live traffic, they've already been exposed to a lot of things that it would normally take 6-8 months to see. For example, a hijack or an actual emergency or unusual weather, something like that. We're getting them exposed to all that and how to handle it.
Where are you getting your simulator scenarios from?
A lot of it we're making ourselves. There's one controller that came up with a program for the FAA. It's a leaps and bounds ahead of what we had before. And we can actually fly the airplanes almost totally realistically. It's not completely realistic. It's a simulator. And the student is not going to go into the room and work as with the same traffic that's on the simulator, just like any simulator. You put a lot of stuff in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
How often does it, when you get a 737 type rating, how often do you fly the real airplane and you lose an engine, you lose the hydraulics, this, you know, all of that. So it's all compressed, but at least they get exposed to it.
So you're taking the expertise of your background and the years, the 100 years of experience in the room. You're using technology to create lifelike scenarios, and you're working with people who are used to using these kinds of technological devices to take in and process information and learn information.
That's correct.
What does personality have to do with it? I'm going to give myself another. A little bit of time. What does personality have to do with it?
In what way? I'm not sure.
Do you find that somebody comes in and they can handle playing around with the buttons and the knobs and the radio, but they just don't have a temperament for this kind of work?
There are people like that. That really, and we don't know until we get to that point. We're trying to gear it so those people are screened out early in the process.
So they know and you know that it's not a good fit for
right.
them early on.
That's what we're trying to do.
So Jeff, what we've talked about is that there was an old way to do it, and we kind of pulled together air traffic from the beginning. And now with the increase in air traffic, with GPS, with the younger people coming on, with the need for our facilities, there have been changes, and FAA is using contractors who can meet the need, use the technology, call on experience to get these new people up and running in a safe manner in our air traffic facilities.
That's right.
Well, Jeff Cord, I appreciate it very much. Thank you for this discussion of how the millennials do it in today's air traffic system.
You're welcome, Kathleen.
Come back again, Jeff Cord.
I would like to. Thank you, Kathleen.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Managing Safety, brought to you by the FAA Production Studios, a joint effort of the National Aviation Safety Foundation and the FAA Safety Team. Please visit our studio website at faaproductionstudios.com to hear past programs.